This is WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. America may be gaining ground against terrorists in Afghanistan, but is it losing the bigger war against terrorism worldwide? Coming up, we'll take a look. But first, on its own terms and turf, the state of Virginia takes up the fight. Attorney General-elect Jerry Kilgore has proposed a package of anti-terrorism legislation that's as tough as it is controversial. I asked him what he thinks Virginia can do that the federal government could not.
Right now, in Virginia and across the nation, certain terrorist acts or terrorist attempts are simply not covered by existing law. States need to step up to the plate. It's going to be the state and local responders that are first on the scene, just as it was in New York, just as it was Virginia responders are responding to the Pentagon attacks here in Virginia. We need tough new penalties to deal with the threat of terrorism, and we proposed several pieces of legislation to deal with that in Virginia. First of all, we want to give juries the option in Virginia of imposing the death penalty for the evil masterminds of the terrorist attacks. The death penalty is usually reserved for the individuals that are, if you will, the trigger man.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, the trigger man happens to be some evil mastermind not participating in the crime, but it's clearly the individual that has encouraged and planned and moved these individuals to the point that they're going to create this mass destruction and kill all kinds of innocent men, women, and children.
Jerry Kilgore, you do single out these so-called evil masterminds for the death penalty. Do you think that Osama bin Laden is paying attention to the state laws of Virginia?
Well, you know, I think he's certainly would have to pay attention to state laws all around the nation. Has their coming forward to implement some of their terrorist acts? There are times when, even though the United States laws would allow the death penalty in certain situations, there are times when it's quite frankly easier to use a state court and a state procedure to get the penalty that you want. We were able to do that several years ago in Fairfax County with a terrorist that gunned down individuals outside of CIA headquarters.
We remember that story.
And that individual was actually the trigger man in the in the shooting.
So is that the main thing that a state law can accomplish that federal laws cannot? It would speed and ease the way for tough penalties? Is that what you're saying?
State laws can provide tougher penalties and can make it easier for prosecutors to get these cases over with in a quick fashion. You know, we also need in Virginia and I'm sure many other states to create new laws combating biological, chemical, or nuclear warfare or substances that terrorists may use. Currently, these laws are barely punished, if punished at all, and we need to send the message that they're going to be subjected to life imprisonment if they use biological, chemical, or nuclear substances to commit acts of terror.
I have to ask you if, with these Virginia laws, you're creating a new kind of NIMBY legislation, not in my backyard. Will you spark a race among states to deter local terrorism by being fiercer than your neighbors?
No, you know, I think every state is going to have to look at increasing their penalties and redefining crimes in light of September the 11th. And it's important that we all do that. We have to recognize that criminal law is very fluid and you have to be responsive to the times. And these times, post-September the 11th, call for tough actions and tough new definitions for terrorists and terrorism acts.
What about the view that real terrorists aren't much deterred by punishment? Are these laws really aimed more to be a warning to copycat or hoaxers, not the ideologically driven terrorists?
You know, certainly some of the terrorists that participated in September the 11th were glad to lose their lives in support of their political or religious views. But there are others who aren't, who look at the consequences, who will step back and realize that, you know, they could receive the death penalty for participating, for being the mastermind of these evil attacks, or they could receive life in prison for even aiding and abetting such an act.
Virginia's governor-elect, Mark Warner, ran in part on an anti-terrorism platform. Now you, Jerry Kilgore, have offered up your own proposals. Talk to us about how the war on terror has changed the political agenda, the conversation in state politics. Is it pushing aside education, welfare, health?
Well, you know, since September the 11th, terrorism has been on the minds of not only voters, but upon every citizen. Everywhere I go, and I'm sure everywhere our new governor travels today, he is asked, I'm asked about Virginia's response, and the public expects its government to make them safe, to provide security, and that's what we have to do.
Are you worried about protecting the civil liberties of Virginians in the process of putting forward tougher laws on terrorism?
You know, we can do both. We can pass tough laws, but also continue to require proof beyond a reasonable doubt, continue to provide the constitutional protections against those who are innocent.
But is it in the end a kind of window dressing? Do you think you can really stop these kind of acts with laws?
Well, I think we have to have the ability to charge and prosecute individuals that do commit these acts of terror. I think we send a very important message, just as we have in the past in Virginia when we toughened our laws on other violent crimes, that we're not going to tolerate it in Virginia.
Jerry Kilgore is Virginia's Attorney General-elect. He spoke to us from the National Attorneys General Conference in Newport Beach, California. Even as he was describing the successes of the American military in Afghanistan today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made it clear that the U.S. is by no means approaching the end of the campaign. Many are speculating as to where the U.S. might turn its military might next: Iraq, Somalia, Sudan. But as America looks to broaden its efforts beyond Afghanistan, are its battlefield victories undermining its broader goal? Are the military successes coming at a price that alienates mainstream, moderate Muslims around the world, pushing them to anti-American extremism? Could America's power projection be undermining its own big war against global terrorism? We're joined in the studio tonight by Genevieve Abdo. She's an international journalist and former correspondent in Tehran for The Guardian newspaper. She's also author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. Welcome, Genevieve Abdo.
Thank you.
So you're making a tough point to the kind of main thrust of the American effort in the war on terrorism. And before we really dive into that, tell us about your background in the region. We want to understand your credentials before we have you take this policy apart, if you will.
Sure. When I was in the Middle East, I tried to spend most of my time reporting and also researching a book by interviewing Islamic activists. Now, these are people who are part of the Islamic revival sweeping a lot of the countries that we're talking about right now, but they are not violent. And they don't necessarily want to overthrow their respective governments, even though they would like to see them out of power.
Give us the nuts and bolts of your exposure. You spent almost a decade in Cairo, in Iran, all over the Middle East.
Yes, and part of my assignment was to go to Algeria and interview militants there. I spent a lot of time in the Gaza Strip interviewing Hamas activists. So I tried to focus most of my reporting on Islamic movements.
So, all right, you've got the familiarity with the so-called Arab street and the what you're describing as active Islamists who were not extremists, who were not radicalized, a distinction that's sometimes lost on us here.
Yes.
And now we hear you making the case. You say that the U.S. is actually losing the overall war against terrorism. That's not how it looks on the TV screen. Explain to us what you mean.
The United States stands to lose the long-term battle if they don't stop with Afghanistan. And I think that the recent rhetoric, particularly President Bush's statements last week about Iraq, now we're talking about entering other countries and expanding the war on terrorism, I think this will completely be counterproductive to any gains that are made in ousting the Taliban. Because this is, of course, what Osama bin Laden has wanted and what he's warned the Muslim world about, that the first stop is Afghanistan, the next stop could be Iraq, the third stop could be ousting Arafat from power. So I think that by this kind of rhetoric, the United States is only fueling a lot of anti-American sentiment that is out there among mainstream Muslims.
So what do mainstream Muslims hear when President Bush steps to the podium and says, we're going to take this war wherever we need to take it, you know, we're going to go after terrorists wherever they are, whoever hosted them, whoever gave them succor, whoever is creating weapons of mass destruction? It sounds It sounds in a, hey, let's clean this up while the cleaning is good sense, it sounds reasonable to an American ear. What do mainstream Muslim ears hear?
Mainstream Muslims say you must redefine your terrorism. That what about the terrorism that our own governments practice? This is the first question they ask.
Our own governments meaning who?
Meaning Saudi Arabia, Egypt, our own governments in terms of their lack of human rights, in terms of their policies of torturing people without any sort of due process. Often their own suspected militants go before courts without lawyers. So that's the first question they ask. The second question they will ask is, what about Israel? What about the terrorism Israel practices against the Palestinian? What about the occupation? Why don't you address that problem? The other question that they'll ask is, why don't you make a distinction in your broad term of terrorism between the militants like Osama bin Laden and the Islamic activists who, like us, who are just trying to participate in the political process in our own countries. The other question that they'll ask probably and most important is, what gives the United States the right to determine our futures, whether it be Iraq or any other country? And I think that this is foremost in their minds, that they see that this is some sort of entree into an imperialistic campaign across the Muslim world.
Genevieve Abdo, paint a picture for us of the Middle Eastern Muslim person that you have in mind as you describe this mainstream Muslim. We now, of course, have pictures of Taliban fighters and of Osama bin Laden and of, religious fanatics. Give us a picture. Who is this person? What's their counterpart in U.S. society? Is this a teacher? Is this a firebrand? Who?
These are middle-class professionals, teachers, lawyers, doctors. These are also clerics and sheikhs. There was a very interesting story in the New York Times today. The reporter went to interview a cleric in a very remote part of Saudi Arabia.
Douglas Jell's story.
Yes. And the cleric said, and I quote, he said, "It is the duty of every Muslim to stand up with the Afghan people and fight against America." And the whole idea of this story is that the rhetoric that we're seeing now coming from Washington is a cause for alarm among these kinds of people. Now, this man isn't necessarily a violent cleric, but he's using the United States rhetoric to fuel a lot of anti-American sentiment that already exists among his followers in his mosque in a remote part of Saudi Arabia.
But why doesn't he look at it and say, well, we don't want terrorists, they don't want terrorists, we're on the same page?
Because the problem with a huge war against terrorism is that there are a lot of policy implications that come with this. If the United States bombs Iraq again, it is basically sending a signal to the Muslim world that we are in command, that we control what happens in Iraq, rather than, for example, supporting the Iraqi opposition and allowing this kind of rebellion to take place from within.
But you're saying what's going on in Afghanistan so far is productive, is okay. Did I hear you right?
It seems that it's okay because, of course, we read reports that that the Afghani people are very happy the Taliban is gone. It's not too difficult for people to understand that. And that, of course, there's some process going on now whereby all the ethnic groups in Afghanistan can create some sort of multi-tribal and ethnic government.
So you're saying we've crossed the tripwire in our rhetoric, but we haven't crossed it in actions yet. If we hold it to Afghanistan, don't take it rolling on across the Middle East to Iraq or elsewhere, that we won't tip this against us.
We won't tip this, and also what the United States' response is to the latest violence in Palestine and Israel is key to winning Arab and Muslim opinion.
We're talking tonight with Genevieve Abdo, a journalist who's spent a decade in the Middle East, about whether the U.S. is coming close to winning the battle in Afghanistan, but losing the war against terrorism by creating a new wave of angry, anti-American, potential Islamic terrorists. What do you think? Is the United States striking the right balance between achieving military objectives and political objectives? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk, or join online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the state of the war at large. We're having and seeing a lot of military successes in Afghanistan. But are we at risk of losing the war against terrorism on a broader scale, which is, after all, what this is all about? Our guest tonight, Genevieve Abdo, was a foreign correspondent in the Middle East for almost a decade. She worked for London's The Guardian newspaper. She's author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. Right now, she's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Here's the question. Could America's military successes breed new terrorism, or is it the only way to go? Can America fight its way to victory in this war? Does it have a choice? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Genevieve Abdo, you're making the case that already, just with our rhetoric, we're inflaming the Muslim community, the mainstream Muslim community, not the super radical fringe. What's the evidence of that? I mean, we want that Muslims are turning against America. You know, we heard that Pakistan was going to go up in flames, that there would be, you know, it would just be an apocalyptic mess there. It hasn't turned out to be so. What do you see as the evidence that just our rhetoric alone already is turning mainstream Muslims against the United States and its effort?
I think that perhaps it's not turning them yet in great numbers, but there's a lot of discussion now. For example, when President Bush declared last week, or when he made his statements about Iraq, if you read the Arab press, they considered this to be a declaration of war against Iraq. Now, the Gulf War was never popular among mainstream people in the Arab and Muslim world. They always believed that the United States should never have bombed Iraq.
They would have been happy if Saddam stayed in Kuwait?
They wouldn't have been happy if Saddam stayed in Kuwait, but they felt that too many civilians had died in the war. And in fact, there was an interesting statistic just a few weeks ago circulating that in proportion to the population of Iraq, that the United States and the coalition were responsible for killing something like 14 million people if you compared its population to ours. So in proportionate numbers, it would be...
Proportionately, if it had been in America.
Yes, mm-hmm. If it had been in America. It would be as if we'd killed 14 million
people. As a percentage of the population.
Iraqis, I've been to Iraq. I reported from Iraq. Iraqis believe that it was definitely an unfair campaign. So again, this kind of rhetoric is deja vu for a lot of Arabs and Muslims.
But what's the evidence that we're really at this volatile point with the mass of Muslims in the Middle East?
The evidence is what people are saying from their pulpits in the mosque, what clerics are saying. The evidence also is that polling has been done just recently in the Gaza Strip showing that ordinary Palestinians are now supporting Hamas, whereas before they did not. There were student elections, for example, a few weeks ago in the universities, and for the first time, students voted overwhelmingly for candidates who align themselves with Hamas. Now, these are ordinary people.
And you're linking that to the United States? Isn't that an Israeli-Palestinian problem?
Yes, it's an Israeli-Palestinian problem. However, it is the United States that is perceived to be behind a lot of what happens in the Middle East. Now, sometimes this is true, sometimes this is not true, but this is the perception.
But what about the theory of the case that Tom Friedman has often presented in his writing in the pages of the New York Times, Hama rules, that what's respected in this region is power and its ruthless use, and that if you've got an enemy, kill them and pave over their city and they'll respect you?
That's a very simplistic analysis of what happens. The reason that President Assad did what he did in Hama and killed thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, was that he was an authoritarian ruler. This is exactly what Osama bin Laden's campaign is about. It is removing leaders who continue to rule in this repressive kind of reign of terror. There is no support for this kind of rule in the Middle East. And people like Thomas Friedman want to sort of paint the Middle East as people who only respond to aggression and force. But in fact, that is not the case.
So you're saying if we're seen to be taking that path, then we look like another authoritarian power, not like a friend.
Absolutely. And from the Arab and Muslim point of view, the fact that we support governments such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt is already enough evidence for them to believe that this is true.
Genevieve Abdo, we have a pile of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's turn to them now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Can America fight its way to victory in this war? Does it have a choice? Kareem is on the line. Welcome, Kareem.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, thanks.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment, first of all, about Hama. I was born and raised in Syria,
okay.
And I was there when Hama happened.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a comment that people over there respect that authoritarian rule is really false. I remember, really, it was just absolute fear. I mean, in a country like Syria, where there is a stable government, there's really nothing you can do. But what you have in Palestine, I believe, is just complete and utter frustration.
So you're drawing a distinction between fear and frustration?
Well, I think they're coupled in Palestine. You know, I mean, they're, you know, in Syria, most people are still getting by. They're still able to have food on the tables and jobs and that kind of thing. Once you start to take all those things away, you take away their homes, you take away food, steady income, that type of thing, you know, then you're sort of reach a point of frustration where there's, you know, you almost have no choice, no recourse other than that kind of thing.
Kareem, you have a background in the region. What do you think of the U.S. effort so far in the Middle East in this war on terrorism? Is it hitting the right note or is it turning people against the American effort?
Well, I think that it is definitely turning people against the effort.
Because why?
You have to understand that for years, the governments over there have been force-feeding people the line that, you know, America is sort of the enemy, not in official ways, but it's always been a sort of subliminal way, because the government would not want be known to the United States that they're actually saying that to their people. But that was always felt, that there's always an anti-American mentality in a very unofficial tone.
But if it's what's been there all along, that would say maybe it's not because of what we're doing now. Maybe we need to be doing what we're doing now to defend the country.
Well, this is definitely fueling it. You also have to understand that there's also different sort of segments of the society. You can't say all Syrians feel anti-American and all Arabs. I mean, you have your Christians, you have your moderate mm-hmm. Muslims, and then so on and so forth.
Point taken.
So there are definitely, there is an anti, I think, American feeling, but also that's fueled by helplessness, is that why haven't you come to help us? This is, America is the country, the beacon of democracy, you know, and here we have been under the rule of Assad or whomever, or Mubarak in Egypt for all these years. We've been left stranded. And now all of a sudden you're turning, you know, your warplanes on us.
So, Kareem, thanks for your call. I want to put that to Genevieve Abdo. And so Kareem is saying, I guess you're saying, too, they don't see the new arrival of the U.S. military in the Middle East as bringing the things that they want, democracy, a better economy. They see it as potentially a threat.
Yes, and also they see the same pattern of policy happening, policies sort of reoccurring. Now we have a coalition. We have Arab governments, at least in their rhetoric, supporting this coalition. That means that there is no hope for people who oppose U.S. intervention in the region from ever really having a voice in this matter. And this is exactly what Kareem is saying. They're saying, well, why don't you come and help the Egyptians? We have wanted to have some sort of pluralistic political system, but we're not even allowed to run Islamic candidates in elections. Why don't you help us in Saudi Arabia? So this is the frustration that we're seeing now.
Mm. Genevieve Abdo, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Jack Spencer. He's a defense analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Jack Spencer, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, I don't know if you've heard, but we're hearing the case tonight that apart from or unlike what you might conclude from some of the images on television and the way the map of Afghanistan has changed in the last weeks, here's a case that says, in fact, Washington may be baubling this bigger war on terrorism. We've got some military victories in our pocket, but we're turning the mass of mainstream Muslims in the Middle East against us. And if we go any further, we've got a real problem on our hands. Is that how you see it?
No, not at all. Not unless you take a very the point of view that Muslims are terrorists. Where this is not a war against Muslims. Therefore, if in fact we were turning Muslims against the United States, that would not be increasing terrorism. This is a war against terrorism. We're fighting alongside with Muslims against this war on terrorism. I have been listening. I can't say that I disagree more with the other guests. So that's sort of where I come from, that I deny that that's the case. And I don't see this rise throughout the Middle East of people reacting negatively to the United States and the war on terrorism. They understand the United States was attacked. We've been very clear from the beginning that it's not a war against Islam by any means. It's simply a war against the terrorists who attacked the United States and against any government who continues to support those terrorists.
Genevieve Abdo warns that we're already working up a lot of anti-American sentiment, and if we go further, as President Bush has rather fiercely warned we may well this week, if we go further, we cross a kind of tripwire that will really turn the region against us. Jack Spencer?
I simply deny that that's the case. The fact of the matter is Saddam Hussein is developing weapons of mass destruction. He has supported international terrorism in the past and continues to do so. If Saddam Hussein doesn't want if he wants to maintain control of his regime, he can do so very simply by continuing to behave in a way that he has, and that's by stopping to produce weapons of mass destruction.
Genevieve Abdo, here it is. It's the perspective that, look, there are terrorists there. They've got weapons that are dangerous to us and to themselves. We're justified in going in, and the Muslim world will see that. What's wrong with the logic?
We have to make a distinction between the support for violence and terrorism and support for self-determination. There is very little support, as we have seen, for the violence carried out by Osama bin Laden. This is why you don't see massive demonstrations now in Pakistan, for example. And most Muslims who have spoken out on this issue have made this very clear. They in no way support the 6,000 or so people who died in the World Trade Center attack. However, that does not mean that they support direct intervention by the United States in their respective countries. This is a completely different issue. And this is a grievance that Osama bin Laden has against the United States, which carries widespread support in the Arab and Muslim world, even though they don't approve of his methodology, his tactics, mm-hmm. which are very violent. Mm-hmm. And we have to make this distinction. People, of course, don't support terrorism. Even the normal Palestinian on the street will tell you that maybe suicide bombings is not the right approach to end the occupation. Mm-hmm. But this does not mean that they agree with the United States' position in the Arab-Israeli conflict. In fact, just listen to Hanan Shaarawy today, who has been on several talk shows.
Palestinian leader.
Palestinian leader Hanan Shaarawy. She makes very clear the United States has to reassess its position. It cannot continue to support the terrorism carried out by Ariel Sharon in the occupied territories.
Ariel Sharon is simply responding to the terrorist attacks that have been occurring in his country for some time now. But I think what we got to get back to is the fact that I thought an important point was made earlier, mm-hmm. that people in that region respect power, they don't respect power. You know, I sort of agree with
Genevieve here in the studio.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, they don't respect brutal power. No one respects brutal power. Mm-hmm. There's something different between using brutal power to oppress people and showing commitment to one's cause. It's showing commitment to one's cause that is respected. Using brutal power to oppress people, that's not what the United States is doing there. But what the United States is doing right now is showing commitment to what it said it's going to do. And I think they are showing respect for that. And also I agree that it is about self-determination. And if you see the United States go into Afghanistan, Afghanistan and occupy Afghanistan and impose a certain government on Afghanistan, mm-hmm. then you're going to see the Afghan people turn on the United States very quickly. But that's not the plan as of right now for the United States for the future of Afghanistan, and I hope that doesn't become the plan. I believe the same will be true in Iraq if, in fact, Iraq is if the United States decides that Iraq is the next place we have to go. The Iraqi people will not support the United States coming in and imposing a new government on Iraq, nor should they. However, there is ample opposition to the terrorist regime of Saddam Hussein, and we can work with those people on the ground the same way we're doing with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan to bring about a change of regime in Iraq, when it does not export terrorism, when it does not develop weapons of mass destruction, and facilitate and help that new regime be a successful democratic or whatever sort of regime the people of Iraq want. That's the important thing. I agree. We have to allow self-determination for all people, and we can't just go around intervening for fun. We have to understand that the United States was attacked, and there is still a threat out there.
Jack Spencer, you think we've got it about right?
Yeah, I do. So far, we could step off the path at any moment, but so far, I think we're doing a fine job.
Jack, can you stand on? We have a lot of callers who want to join. Let's bring one in right now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to support your guest point and extend it a bit, because it seems to me that it's not
our guest. You're talking Genevieve Abdo or Jack Spencer here?
Genevieve Abdo.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not only within the Muslim world that people oppose the United States attacking Iraq, but it's our European allies and a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a fundamental contradiction in the administration's policy that we say we're fighting for civilization mm-hmm. and not just an American battle, mm-hmm. but we want to make all the decisions completely unilaterally. And we're not willing to do any of this through the United Nations. We're not willing to consult with other people. I mean, even within our own country, there's barely any debate in Congress or any other place.
Steve, we've got your point, and our time's running down. Let me put it to Genevieve and then to Jack. Genevieve, what about it? Steve points out it's not only some complaints in the Middle East, but from European allies who are not enthusiastic about a next move here.
Brilliant point, Steve. And if you read the European papers, you will see, for example, the press is much more cynical about our activities in Afghanistan and in the region in general than the American press. That's point one. The second point is that if you read even what Switzerland is saying, what France is saying in the last few days about the United States position regarding the Palestinian issue, regarding the threats against Iraq, it's exactly what you're saying. There's a lot more skepticism than anything that you could pick up from listening to what's coming out of Washington or reading the American press.
Mm. Jack Spencer, what about that? What do you make of the European skepticism about the American approach?
The Europeans are often skeptical, but they often, again, come along with us whenever we show commitment. The bottom line is that the United States is not out to make friends. We're out to protect the United States from falling victim to further terrorist attacks. And I think that's what we have to remember.
Can we win by not making friends in the Middle East, though? Don't we need friends there?
Yeah, I don't think we should go around trying to make enemies, but I believe that commitment that will make you friends, and that's what leadership is all about. Leadership's not always following what the consensus is, but doing what's right. The consensus and right don't always coincide.
Jack Spencer, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Jack Spencer is a defense analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Well, there you have it, Genevieve Abdo. It's about standing up for our national interests and not just making friends.
Yes, of course. We have to protect our national interest, and we have to somehow fight the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center. But that's a completely different issue than expanding our whole notion of terrorism throughout the region.
We're talking about the U.S. war on terrorism and whether, despite our apparent victories, we may be at risk of losing it. Genevieve Abdo says if we go further, we may. Can America fight its way to victory in this war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the state of the war on terrorism tonight with Genevieve Abdo, a decade in the Middle East and author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. What do you think? Is the United States striking the right balance between achieving military objectives and political objectives? And are we at risk, as Genevieve Abdo thinks, of going too far if, as President Bush predicts, we take this war deeper into the Middle East, to Iraq, maybe to Somalia, maybe to Sudan? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Roy is on the line. Hi, Roy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Yeah, my point is pretty simple, yet, I feel factual, i.e., on one hand, you have very simplistic black and white approach from the masses on the Muslim side, globally that is,
mm-hmm.
which is everything U.S. has done has been not only just self-interest but also anti-Muslim coming from the masses' perspective, you know, starting from the creation of Israel but leaving Palestinian creation or create a state of Palestine out of the equation, even though that was mm-hmm. part of the U.N. resolution,
mm-hmm.
supporting the Israel all along. Giving weapons, aids, and so on and so forth. And if you take each and every Muslim country, they all have this impression and experience of the U.S. where they all where the U.S. walked away every time they were done needing whatever they needed or creating the dictators like Saddam Hussein and Shah and so on and so forth, but then leaving the country in a mess when things didn't go the way they wanted it to go.
Okay, so we know we're not the most popular guy on the block there.
Right. On the other side, for some reason, U.S. just doesn't get it. I mean, the people don't get it because half of them, or most of them, don't even bother even voting. I mean, they're not even interested in the local issues, let alone global issues. So they have this idea that maybe if we can hire a corporate marketing woman or someone, we can change it all because Muslims just don't know anything what's going on.
So what's your bottom line, Roy?
That, Muslims feel that not only they're being insulted intellectually, emotionally they feel pretty angry, and also not to forget they're looking at it from a weaker perspective where they're not being represented even in their countries locally, and nobody, therefore they don't have any global voice. So basically we are all fooling ourselves by just talking to the regimes over there, and it's just more of the same.
So, Roy, how could the United States address this threat that it clearly has to address and simultaneously win an alliance with the masses in the Middle East?
Well, by doing something real on the ground, i.e. making the state of Israel state of Palestine 50-some years ago, if not today, on the emergency basis, whereby masses will be turned or be won over to our side. Not only that, even locally, I don't even feel then Muslims are being welcomed by the American neighbors. If anything, they're suspicious of them. There are a lot of nice people as
well. You mean inside the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
But President Bush has had Ramadan dinners at the White House. I mean, we've had a lot of outreach effort. Hasn't there been? Or do you still feel that there's a...
Not on an individual basis. I mean, you see, right after the 9/11, if you were living in Muslim shoes, you'll see on the street you were getting 10 stares and maybe one or two kind smile, which was great, with a scarf on their shoulder and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. Majority is not doing it, because the reason why Bush had to defend and say what he had to say was because there was so much ignorance. That means that statement alone is not enough. We need real measures on the ground, and we need real effort. We need to start thinking globally as opposed to nation state.
Roy, we got it. We got it. We got your point, and we thank you for it. Genevieve Abdo, Israel always comes up, but yet we heard at the beginning of this that it was not even on Osama bin Laden's real initial agenda. He just added it on there as kind of a political sop to bring in more support. Here it is again in the caller's comments. What about that point? What does the United States need to do there to both respect its commitments to an old ally, Israel, and to be seen as reasonable in the region?
The United States needs to recognize Yasser Arafat, first of all, as a legitimate leader of the Palestinian people.
This week he's practically been called Osama bin Laden.
Absolutely. He's completely been discredited by the United States.
But
and
buses
by,
are
and
blowing up. People are dying. There is terrorism on the ground here.
But Yasser Arafat is the elected leader of the Palestinian people. There was a fair election, which I covered, in the territories. He's an elected leader. We don't say that about other elected leaders. We don't just assume that the United States or that another country can somehow eliminate elected leaders of countries. I mean, that's not considered to be fair policy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is a long history of somehow viewing the Palestinian position in this conflict as somehow inferior, that their interests don't count. I mean, we read columns all the time, even today, telling people that, well, the Palestinians had their chance, and they didn't take this great opportunity offered to them at Camp David. It wasn't a great opportunity, and the Palestinians are fond of saying they have always been offered a compromise of a compromise. They want to get back to the 1967 borders. That should be some sort of basis of negotiation. Instead, they've been offered dwindling territory, lack of any sort of legitimate state. And so the United States really hasn't been a fair broker in the peace process, and at least this is how it's perceived across the Arab world.
We're talking about the big picture of the war on terrorism. Is victory in Afghanistan, if indeed we're close, the first step in a successful war on terrorism? What else do we need to do? Does the United States need to do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Marty's on the line. Welcome, Marty.
Thanks. Thanks for having me in and
sure.
taking my question.
Fire away.
I basically have two questions.
Okay.
One, I wonder why an air campaign is necessarily means that you exclude a campaign to support the people opposed to Saddam Hussein.
Well, you're saying earlier there was some criticism that if the United States used air power in Iraq, that would be wrong, and you're challenging that idea.
Well, I don't see why that means we can't use it to support the people who want to overthrow Saddam.
Okay, point taken. And number two?
Number two, Janine, I'm kind of curious. Can you name me any time when there's been a progress in the peace process between the Arabs and the Israelis when there hasn't been a massive military defeat suffered by the Arabs?
Okay, we'll take them both, Marty. The first point that Marty makes is, Geneva Abdo, what's necessarily wrong with using air power to support the ouster of Saddam Hussein? He's clearly not a popularly elected leader in Iraq.
No, absolutely not. And any Iraqi will tell you that, of course, they don't support Saddam Hussein. Iraqis, at least from my interviews in Iraq over the years, they're not necessarily opposed to an air campaign as long as that air campaign is part of a larger strategy that would help the opposition. And also, as long as we're not talking about killing innocent civilians. I mean, many Iraqis told me that, of course, they don't support Saddam Hussein, but they have these horrifying memories of the United States air campaign. Artists told me stories. Middle-class professionals told me stories. Mm. The persons who's impoverished in ghettos tell stories. They have these horrific memories of living under this air campaign. This is what they don't want. They don't want innocent civilians to be killed.
That we cannot look just if we bring that on.
Absolutely.
And the second point Marty makes is, he asserts that Arabs, Palestinians, only respond to crushing defeat in the standoff in Israel and the West Bank.
I would make the exact opposite argument. Whenever there is a direct relationship between the decline in the peace process and the increase of Hamas bombings. As soon as there is a crisis, as soon as there is a deadlock, and we saw this particularly in 1996 and in the mid-90s, as soon as there's a deadlock in the peace process, no hope for any sort of resolution, that's when you see more Israeli repression and more suicide bombings.
Geneva Abdo, you've said earlier in our conversation that we're on the brink of giving Osama bin Laden exactly what he wants, but how is that so? He's cowering in a cave, we think. His forces or troops are scattered, imprisoned, dead in Afghanistan. Surely the al-Qaeda's operations have been somewhat disrupted. How can this be giving Osama bin Laden what he wants?
We need to remove Osama bin Laden from this conversation. He's only a vehicle. He's a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
If he dies tomorrow, the problem isn't going to go away if we kill Osama bin Laden. When we say Osama bin Laden, we're talking about his objectives. And as we discussed earlier in this program, those objectives are supported by many people in the Muslim world for all the reasons that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
What is his first objective, which has existed for many years since his first fatwas early on in the early 90s? His first mission is to change the governments in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. There's widespread support for that. So let us not focus so much on Osama bin Laden, the man, the terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
We need to go deeper into what his grievances are. And this is my point. These grievances are those that are supported by many people in the Arab and Muslim world.
So what's the jujitsu of getting on the right side of those grievances? How could the United States, we've only got a minute moderate left, but how could we reach out to moderate Muslims to bring political reform and health to this region instead of being seen as an aggressor?
If you want to use Egypt as an example, and we've supported the Egyptian government for many decades now, there has to be pressure placed on the Egyptian government to make it, to change its political process, to include mainstream Islamists who advocate peace, to allow people like that to run in elections.
Could we do that without chaos there?
Yes, absolutely. Egypt has existed in a state of emergency for 20 years. It is through this state of emergency that the government does not allow free expression. There aren't free newspapers. There are no free elections. People aren't allowed to demonstrate freely.
But you're saying the choice is not clamp down or chaos.
No, absolutely not. The middle way is that if all of these governments want to have a relationship with the United States, they need to change their human rights policies, and they need to allow some sort of democratic process, which their societies are calling for.
Geneva Abdo, so much. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
Geneva Abdo is a former correspondent in Tehran and Cairo for London's The Guardian newspaper. She's author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. And this year, she's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. As we do frequently, we're going to listen now to voices of people around the country. Tonight we hear from people in Oakland, California, where independent producer Nahani Rose spoke to visitors to Lake Merritt, a public park downtown.
My name is Suzanne Ziegler. I live in Oakland, California. I've lived here for 3 years. I was actually born and raised here and left when I was 20 and came back 3 years ago. But I do remember being distressed kind of from the second day, September the 12th, when people like the president and like one of our U.S. senators said that this was a war, and people likened it to Pearl Harbor, and it didn't seem to me that it was anything like Pearl Harbor, and I didn't like the comparison being made because I didn't like the consequences of that kind of comparison. Temperamentally, I'm not a flag waver, so I feel, you know, somewhat alienated by the fact that so many people seem to be into a kind of America right or wrong thing, which I don't feel that myself. I mean, I was in the post office the other day buying stamps, and I wanted the kind that are sticky on the back, and the only ones I saw were Christmas stamps, and I don't celebrate Christmas, and flag stamps. And I really didn't want flag stamps. I mean, another time I wouldn't have cared, but I just didn't want them. And so I said, do you have anything besides Christmas and flags? And then I thought, you know, are people in the back going to start throwing spitballs at me?
Tanja Wright, I'm from Oakland. I attend Laney College. My major is accounting. Well, I just wish they would stop the war if you let them know that how many people would like for them to end this war as soon as possible. I would like for the people, the men, to come home, because it's hard for the families to really have a Christmas knowing that their son and daughter is out there on the battlefield ready to die for something they don't even know what happened. So they dying for a cause they really know nothing about. Yes, they sign their life over to the military, and the military is in control of their life. But even the military should have a better say-so over a human's life than to just put them on a battlefield for something they know nothing about.
My name is Henry Charles. I'm from Menlo Park. I follow it at the beginning, and after a while, it gets kind of tired and boring. But the little bit I follow, what made me upset was the fact that there's death behind everything, and that's what turned me off about the whole thing. There was no solution. Honestly, me talking to people, people are very glad that we're doing that, honestly. And it frightens me that we as Americans feel that way. Because if we're going to lead by example, that's not the way to do it. You know, the way to do it is say, hey, okay, let's find this guy, arrest him. We're bombing the whole country, and we still haven't found them. Okay, let's send some troops out there on foot. Let's not mess with the innocent people. Of course, we're going to have some guns shed because there are people with guns, of course, on the ground. But instead of bombing, like, half of the country, is not solving that. I have a little daughter. She's 3 years old, and I would hate for her to grow up knowing that this is how we are as humans. But it goes back in the past. We always have been like that. I don't want her to grow up thinking, you know, terrified that You know, we can go and bomb anybody, and our people can come over here and do that. I don't want that. No.
Suzanne Ziegler, Tondra Wright, and Henry Charles live in Oakland, California. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for Radio Diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other Radio Diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
From Boston.